This, for me, is the single biggest unsolved mystery of being a founder.
Rachel Carroll is the founder and CEO of Koru Kids, a childcare startup that helps busy parents in the UK.
We are Koru Kids. We're building the world's best childcare service.
Previously, Rachel was CEO of a healthcare company, which she grew to 1.3 million paying users in three countries.
She's also an ex-McKinsey consultant and an experienced hiring expert.
I definitely place a massive emphasis on skills and talent development in my own team.
The problem is that job descriptions suck. No one tells you what it's going to feel like. They might tell you some of the elements of the job, but they don't tell you what percentage of your time is going to be in each of the elements. Just the day-to-day, like, what is your life going to be like if you do this job? No one tells you that. So our job ads are unusual. They are way more... I really believe in blind hiring. And this is when you don't look at, certainly not a photo or a name, but you also don't look at the institution or the qualifications. There's two reasons to do blind hiring. One is, I think the problem solving we look for is actually quite rare, but the values we look for are not rare. What we're really trying to do is identify anyone who would be like unusually bad. We have a technical term, we call them dickheads. Whew, there's quite a lot in this topic. So
what should people know about you?
So my name is Rachel. I run a company called Koru Kids. And Koru is a word that kind of sums up so many things about me, because it's a Māori word. I'm from New Zealand, and it is a shape. It's a fern as it grows. I've got three kids, and my eldest child's middle name is Fern, so that bit's kind of in there. And then Koru also translates, because of its shape, it translates as loop. And so the whole point of Koru Kids is we are a loop of care around the families and the childcare workers that we help.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I read in my research that Dave came up with this name while he came back from a run, but it was like sort of right at the start of when you were starting.
Yeah.
So like that seems like a lot of foresight into the name right at the start.
Well, I think he knew all those things. He knew that it was loop, and I remember him coming back from this run and saying, I think you should call it Koru Kids. And I was like, yes, that's perfect.
Love that. But today we will park the specificities of Koru Kids, but obviously to any founders listening, it's incredible. Who are parents, it's obviously incredible, and so many people use it, and people in founders, which is where we know each other from, rave about it to no end. However, there's lots of incredible podcasts and interviews you've done around Koru, so we'll park the specificities of what the company does and go more into what I think you're an expert at, which is the people side of Koru. And we'll start off quite broad, which is generally, how do you think about building an effective team?
So a lot of what I think is based on bad experiences I had before I founded Koru Kids. And so I think really good and healthy practices were based on me experiencing and seeing things in, so I've worked in the NHS, I've worked in consulting, and in consulting you actually get to go into lots of clients. So I saw lots and lots of different companies there. Worked for a German pharmaceutical wholesaler, I worked for an aluminium smelter. So anyway, bunch of different places. And I just saw a whole bunch of things there. And I would kind of be fascinated by why no one wants to have a bad time at work. Everyone wants to go into work and do a good job, right? And I think a lot of the foundation of my beliefs in this stuff is that I think people want to do a good job. I have trust and faith in humans. And yet what actually happens is they go in and they spend their whole time fighting with each other or doing something which is pointless and doesn't lead to any result, feeling frustrated, doing the wrong job where, you know, their strengths are not matched to what the job actually is. And, you know, you get extroverts in introvert jobs and introverts in extrovert jobs, and there's just waste everywhere you see. And it's sad and it annoys me. And so I always thought, okay, what would a company look like that would that was just founded on principles of like efficiency and people doing the jobs that they liked and doing jobs with in a way that they liked and with people that they liked. And it's the greatest privilege of a founder that you get to actually just like do that from a blank sheet of paper. And so by the time, because I was relatively old when I founded Koru Kids, I wasn't like a 20-year-old founder to like 20s in my 20s. I was 36. So by the time because I'd thought about that for a long time, and also my academic background is I have a PhD in political economy, which is really all about thinking about systems. I'm obsessed with thinking about systems and dynamics of systems. So I'd already had an entire career thinking about that. So I came to this with a lot of thoughts and like beliefs. And so right from the start, I was thinking about I want it to be a very high trust environment because that's much more efficient, where you don't have to have policies, you don't have to spell things out for people. I want it to be an environment where we think very carefully about matching people to roles. And I think that has to happen right from the start in terms of how you hire and how you do your job descriptions. And we can go into that. And then I thought the communication between people needs to reinforce that sense of trust. So that means we need to build a place where people can be open about what's going on. I think there's a lot of displaced energy, if you kind of think of like physics. There's the energy needed to go forward, and then there's like all the other waste energy, right? If you think of a car, like the sound is waste energy, the heat is waste energy, like all the other things that aren't just like making it go forward are waste energy. And because we at Koru Kids and like many startups are all trying to do such hard things, you can't have any waste, because like you're almost certainly going to fail anyway. So because 90% of everything fails. So if you've got to have any chance of being in that 10%, you've got to get rid of the waste. And so I would think, you know what, we need 100% of everyone's brain focused on the mission. And I don't want any time to be wasted thinking, if we're in a meeting together and we're trying to solve this really hard problem, I don't want part of your brain thinking, why is Rachel looking at me like that? Or like, oh, she hates my idea. Or, you know, that body language is she's bored or something like that. That's a distraction. It's getting in the way of us solving the problem. And it might be that actually the reason I'm sitting like that, or my face did that or whatever, is because of something completely unrelated, right, that happened before, maybe in my personal life. And so one of the things I thought about was, okay, how can we surface those things? How can we have a really transparent but also very supportive culture? But it's all to make people have a good, positive time and really ultimately to further the mission as much as possible.
That is so rich. Such rich.
Sorry, there was quite a lot in there.
No.
That was tip of the iceberg.
Go on as much as you like when going into these topics. I love it. Touching on that last bit that you mentioned, we're going to touch on all of these things, like how you match people to roles and communication and feedback and building trust. Starting with the last thing you mentioned, which is culture and having this transparent culture. Now, the very old and archaic way of building culture is these are our values and that's how you should interact in the workplace, and that was the end of it. But that's not how culture is built in reality, and it comes down to these daily actions, which is something I know that you are incredible at. So what does the system look like if you have systematized this area with putting your culture into daily actions?
So we have a lot of systems for various different things on culture. One of the things that I actually find difficult now in thinking about it is I've been doing this now for 8 years and I've forgotten what normal companies are like. So now, because the whole reason we're doing it is because it seems so obvious to me that this is better. And now I struggle to remember which bits are like weird and interesting. But, you know, one of the things we do is we have a very strong feedback culture, for example. Let me just focus on that aspect because there's so many different parts to culture. So for feedback, we have a system where every 6 months you will run your own feedback session. And we very much have a playbook, and we got there by iteration. So we used to do it in other ways. We used to do a more traditional 360. We used to do it written. what we have discovered is that the best way for us to do it is to do it in person, but by that I mean Zoom, but like synchronous over video. Pre-COVID, we used to do it actually in person. So in the true in-person version, you sit in a room and you've invited some number between about 6 and about 10 people that you work with, like that are for you a good sample of the company. So a couple of people who work for you, you might have everyone who works for you, a couple of managers, a couple of peers, and you might decide to invite someone who's in a completely different team because you want to get their perspective. So you decide who the rich perspective like is going to be. And you also, this bit's really crucial, you think about the questions that you want them to be answering. And your standard question is like, what am I doing well? What could I be doing better? And if you can't think of anything else, it's a fine place to start. Nothing wrong with that. But often you can really take your session up a level if you ask more thoughtful questions. So you might say you really want to improve your communication style. You know, you might say to them, thinking about the last 3 times I communicated with you, what would have made it more effective and what was confusing about it or something like that. I don't know, like ask a specific question. And then people find they get a lot more out of it when they do that. So you send out your questions in advance, and we make a big deal internally, culturally, about how important it is to take those questions seriously when you receive them. So if I'm doing your feedback, if you're asking me to give you feedback and you send me the 3 questions, it's really on me to take some time, sit in a little room and like really think about the feedback, you know, my thoughtful feedback. And I'm going to package that up, and that's a gift. And we think of that as like a gift that I'm going to give you. Anyway, and then at your time, we now do it using Zoom and Slack. So you, let's say AJ, you're the subject of the feedback. You will do a
Please
Zoom session.
Yeah.
You'll do a Zoom session, and your manager will also be on in the Zoom for the entire time, but they'll turn their screen off and be on mute. And the reason they're there is just to take notes, be kind of listening, so that they can do a debrief with you afterwards and help you find the themes. But aside from that, they're meant to kind of be in the background as much as possible. And the person comes in and they have a 5-minute slot or 10 minutes maybe. That they come in and they say their feedback, and then you are only allowed to ask any clarifying questions. So you might, for example, ask if they have an example or something like that. And then you just simply say thank you, and then they go away again and the next person comes in. And so you get kind of 6 to 10 like versions of that within a pretty concentrated amount of time. 2 things happen when you do this. Number one is, I very often, people who are joining the team for the first time get very nervous about this, and they're kind of like psyching themselves up for it, and they think it's going to be like they're going to be torn down, and they really think it's going to be negative. And every single time, there's never been an exception to this that I've seen, afterwards they are like buzzing, because a lot of what people say is very positive. This is, by the way, why it's very important to do it synchronous and in person and to your face, because we found that when people didn't written, they were much more brutal. And this is maybe something about social media, and people just do not say all the stuff. And the same person would, when you look at their notes, they look quite brutal, and then they come to say it and they express it with the tone and the examples. They're still saying the same message. They're not watering down the message, but it does not feel brutal. It actually feels positive. And they couch it as like to really take things to the next level, you know, you do this and blah, blah. The first thing is people feel really good at the end of it. But the second effect, which I think is really important for building widespread trust in an organization, which is just, that is like the business. When you've got trust in an organization, everything is easier. It's the most important currency. Anyway, the thing is, you know that what has needed to be said has been said. There's never been a case of this, but like if you found out that someone had something to say and they didn't say it to you in a feedback session, that would be like so weird. So they definitely have said it. And because of that, the reason that's so magical is because there's nothing to worry about, because you know all the stuff. Like you get everyone's stuff and you put it on a table and you look at it and you know that's the stuff. And then your manager's there and the manager's going, yep, that's the stuff. And then you go, okay, well, there's 2 types of stuff here, isn't there? Yep, okay. Well, what are we going to do? There's that stuff there. What are we going to do about that? Okay, well, let's talk about that. Okay, yeah. And it's like, it's done and it's good.
Good stuff. How often do you have these feedback sessions?
Every 6 months.
Amazing. And do you train people on how to give feedback? Because that sounds like that's a skill in and of itself.
We do. We used to do formal training. So we used to have a feedback training session. But what I've discovered about this culture stuff is if you invest in it enough, and we invested very heavily early on, 8 years on, you don't really have to do it that much anymore because it's very self-sustaining. You wouldn't have a feedback session yourself before you'd been to several others, right? And so you kind of get the picture and you pick these things up. And I think that's very true of many aspects of culture. So I think when I don't know what the magic number is, maybe for us it was, when did culture start to become truly self-sustaining? Like around about 10 people, I think. If you drop another person in there, they just start behaving like the other 10. They just do. Unless they're really, really countercultural person, but that's where your hiring process is like weed out those people. But you don't have to get it perfect after about 10 people because it just becomes self-sustaining. Unless you suddenly do a big jump, which we did do, and that's when our culture did go off a little bit at one point and we had to like pull it back and do some focus sessions. But by and large, people kind of absorb it. So the feedback sessions, so we did do formal feedback training, and it was very much modelled on like the stuff that I learned in consulting, a classic playbook for feedback.
Okay, can you give us a very high level of what that is?
Yeah, you do. I have observed that, whatever, this is the framework. I have observed that, something, the effect that had on me was something. In the future, you could consider doing something else. And then maybe some extra consequence. And then you both say thank you. There's a pause bit as well where you pause for clarification. So the idea of this framework is a very, very good framework. And the idea of it is it depersonalizes. It's hard to do that framework properly and have it go wrong. It doesn't allow you to say you always, you never, you know, like overgeneralize. And it also makes it very hard to disagree with it because you're saying it as fact. So like, I have observed that you arrived after 2 o'clock 3 times last week. Fact, right? And you can't you can agree or disagree with that fact, but if that is the case that you did that, then we move to the next step. The effect that had on me was I was left by myself dealing with a lot of different people and that was hard for this reason. Again, it's hard for you can't disagree with that because this is not your perspective, this is my perspective. And then you pause at that point, you know, the one thing that you do need to train people to do is not to jump in with like defensive stuff at that point. It's just simply a clarification. And then you say you could consider doing this. And then the whole thing is packaged up as, again, a gift. So this concept of like you are being offered a gift. You don't have to use the gift, but you're being given a gift. So you don't have to take the gift, use it.
And so what was your last feedback session for you?
Well, here's one that didn't come through a formal feedback session, but I did get recently, which is I recently took a voluntary pay cut in order to give some of the lowest paid people in our team a pay rise. I thought that was a good thing to do, and I thought that was something that would be nice to tell people. And my COO and like announced it, said that as part of a general kind of salary update at our all hands. And I thought that was fine. And then I got this feedback from like multiple people, not directly to me, but via other people actually, that basically that had gone down very badly. And they felt like they were being like guilted by us telling them that. So that for me was very interesting. And I learned from that because I did not think that was going to happen.
What did you learn from that?
I think we could have communicated the changes in a better way. I think we could have said rather than making it more about me, we could have said, you know, we're doing the best that we can right now to give the lowest paid people the biggest increase we can possible. and he is one of the ways that we're doing it. I think it was just, it just hit a slightly wrong note. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like the delivery makes a big impact.
Yeah, a big difference. Yeah. Yeah.
And I love how much you've thought about how language makes an impact, like a gift of feedback.
It's, yeah.
Just completely reframes it, right?
Yeah.
And it's such a simple change.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's incredible. You've said that trust is one of those values which just impacts the whole business. And if there's trust there, everything else flourishes. Is there any other value that comes to mind which has a similar sort of leveraged impact?
I think the other one, it's very related to trust, but openness and the ability to bring your whole self to work. It's one of the ways we create trust, but we also do it for that reason of not wasting energy. Mm-hmm. And whenever anyone joins the Cory Kids team, I have a values discussion with them. And one of the things I always say to them is, we hired you. We didn't hire a robot who looks like you. And because you are a human being and not a robot, you are going to sometimes feel insecure and overwhelmed and scared and confused. And I say that not because I noticed anything in the hiring process for you, but just because you are a human being, and that is what human beings are like. And I don't want you to waste any of your energy pretending to be a robot. I don't see any benefit from anyone coming and pretending to be a robot. And I just want you to know that you can be an actual human being here. And I find that saying that to them really explicitly starts to plant a seed for several practices that we have. And so one of them, for example, is in some of our meetings, not all of our meetings, but some of our meetings, we go around and we do what is called an emotional check-in at the start. And so we do it in our executive meeting, for example. And this is one of my favorite practices, actually, because it's very efficient. And I really like things that have a big impact on culture, but don't take very long and don't cost anything. Those are my favorite things. And so this one, we start off and we just say, okay, how are you? And you have to say, the rule is you have to use three feelings words to describe how you are. And what we often find is that the magic happens in the third word. So often people will say like, bit tired, good, resentful. And you're like, what? What was that third one? And then kind of the truth comes up. And so what we find is it probably takes a maximum of like 2 minutes or something. And if sometimes something really big comes out. So sometimes someone might say, I'm just, one of the parents might say, I can barely think right now. Like my son was not sleeping, you know, something like that. And you can just very quickly go, I'm so sorry to hear that. You know, we'll bear that in mind and then you can move on. And for the rest of that meeting, if that person feels disengaged or, you know, seems kind of off, you now know why it is. It's because of that. And you know it's not because whatever reason, whatever story you might otherwise make up, you know, and tell yourself that, oh, that they're not, that we're talking about the new service and they don't believe in the financial projections, you know, because it's the kind of thing people say to each other after a meeting, did you see their body language? You know, yeah, he doesn't believe it, or he's disengaged or something like that. No, there might have been something completely different going on, right? So now you know what was going on. They're exhausted. Or sometimes someone will say something that is work-related and they might have just come from another really, really tough meeting. And in that case, you know, you say, okay, well, we'll pick up about that afterwards. You don't let it derail. You just note it and move on. And we find that you can tell the difference between the meetings, the tough meetings where we do that at the start and the tough meetings where we don't do that at the start. And sometimes I regret it if I don't do it. Let's say we're talking about like the 2025 strategic plan or some topic like that, right? If I kind of go, we're running late, let's just skip. the emotional check-in, I frequently regret it. I'll get halfway through the meeting and I'll think, oh, we should have done that. Because I don't know what's going on for that person right now, today.
Removes any assumptions.
Exactly.
That might come up in the meeting.
Yeah, exactly. But it has to go hand in hand with trust, because you have to create, you couldn't just walk into any group of people and do that. You have to have already created the knowledge that it's okay to say that stuff. And so we were quite, I was quite deliberate about that actually also. And role modeling it myself, I made very sure that I acknowledge mistakes that I make frequently in front of the team, especially in front of junior members. I remember very early on one of my team saying at the stand-up that she had a panic attack on the way to work. And while I felt for her, I also was so glad that she said that, because it just, again, started to completely normalize just being able to say this stuff.
It's a lot easier to share things when things are going well. Like it doesn't require any sort of vulnerability to say, I had a panic attack, or I'm actually like exhausted because of this thing external, or I feel like I'm not doing a good job, or something. I feel like I'm lacking confidence. That requires a lot of trust for someone to feel confident enough to say that with a group of people. So
yeah,
it makes complete sense. So we've touched on the sort of trust building, bringing your whole self to work, which I think is magical. Now going into what needs to happen in the meeting, which is decision making, usually. Do you have any system for making really effective decisions as a team?
We have a lot of different practices. I think you have to bring the right tool to the right need, to the right kind of decision. So sometimes we might use scenarios to think through something. We very often will use kind of practices from consulting or practices from product, like dot voting. We do lean coffee chat, which I quite like, which is a kind of a product and engineering discipline. That's when you talk about something, you take a straw poll, you then continue talking about it, and you take a straw poll of whether or not you want to keep talking about it for another 2 minutes, or take a decision and move on. So it's a way of kind of polling people very quickly. I have a lot of techniques that I've developed to make decisions myself. Things like trying to get in touch with my own gut. I find there are some people who make decisions with their gut, and they seem to have a direct line to their gut and always know what their gut is thinking. That's cool. I have like a gap between my brain and my gut. I find it hard to get in touch, so I need to use tricks to get myself to kind of know what my instincts actually are. And so there are things like, you might know this one, where you have two alternatives and you have to choose. You've done all the rational thinking, you've modeled them out, you've got your pros and cons, but in the end, you just got to choose. And so you take a coin and you say, okay, heads, it's this one, and you do the coin, and then in the moment, rather than looking at the coin, you just try and figure out which one are you hoping it is. Are you hoping it's heads? And then you know, that's you getting in touch with your guts. There are little tricks like that.
I've also been very neck up,
right,
and find it tricky to get back in touch with the body in general.
Yeah,
tend to be meditating, dancing, Qigong, anything that's like a lot more body oriented, or going for a run.
Yeah.
That just like sort of clears the mind, and then it sort of makes it a more holistic approach to problem solving.
Totally. I also really love, there's a practice called Morning Pages. Have you done this one?
Yeah.
I go through fits and starts with it. Sometimes I need it. I do it when I need to. And when your mind is just so busy and you don't know what to get started with, you take 3 sheets of paper and just write in a complete stream of consciousness, 3 sides of paper, and then stop. And then what I do is I take a highlighter and I highlight all of the actions, and I find that's my day sorted, and it's incredibly clarifying.
It's also brilliant for like reviewing and reflecting on a previous day as well as the upcoming day. How diligent are you with your review process?
I have a 1-line-a-day diary, which I'm very diligent with. So I've been doing that for 2 years now. There are some days, I think I'm now into the three year in a row. So it's one of these diaries that has 5 years on one page, if you see what I mean. So like it will have like April the 20th, like 2020, 2021, 2023, 2024, 2025, whatever.
Sure. Yeah.
And so you go through and you write just one line for each day. And then what is amazing about it is you can, you then look back and you see, okay, this is what it, this is what I was thinking this day last year, this day the year before. And I try to use it to kind of make predictions. I'm quite keen on making predictions and asking questions and then being able to see what my prediction was. And I love the idea that over time you get better and better at making predictions.
That is fabulous. I love that. Because I've journaled lots in the past. I've done morning pages and then done nothing. And then I've done sort of short snippets. But I think actually just making it as simple and easy to do makes it such an easy habit to pick up, right?
Yeah,
Atomic habits approach.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. We've spoken about sort of these really strong values in a team and how they show up in different areas. The thing I find tricky is, how do you assess people against a set of values? How do you do performance management for trust, for openness, if that is something that you include in a performance manager?
The reason it is easier than it might sound, it kind of comes back to my core belief that everyone wants to do a good job, or at least most people do, or at least a lot of people do, enough people do. And so I think it's much more common that someone who wants to do a good job, go to work and like build something cool, gets really frustrated in their job. Not just founders, like all sorts of people feel this because they can't just build the stuff that they actually really want to do. The reason I say that is, it's not like we're looking for rare people. I think the qualities of a human that we're looking for in terms of values are really common qualities. They're like, you want to treat other people well and be treated well. You want to exist in an environment of respect. You want to use your time in a not wasteful way to build something that is of use to others. Like, okay, that doesn't describe every single human in the world, but it just really describes a lot of humans, you know? In some other areas, we're looking for like best of best. We really try to look for great problem solvers, for example. And I think the problem solving we look for is actually quite rare, but the values we look for are not rare. And so therefore, what we're really trying to do is identify anyone who would be like unusually bad at that stuff. And we call those, we have a technical term, we call them dickheads. So we're really just trying to identify dickheads. And like, basically I don't think that many people are dickheads. I think dickheads exist, but I don't think that many people are dickheads. So we do have some sort of like tests, like where we kind of assess whether you're a dickhead. And so for example, in our engineering, they'll do a pairing exercise where they'll like code together, and then we have our panel review, and we all kind of talk together. And it does occasionally happen that one of the engineers was like, he was a bit of a dick. Like, I sat with the guy for an hour, and he didn't take feedback very well, and he was pretty arrogant, and his skills didn't match up to the arrogance level that he had. It was just a bit of a dick, and we don't hire those people.
So then that leads us perfectly into something that you've spoken about a lot, which is your hiring process, which is kind of everything is downstream of a very strong hiring process. And I'd love to go into detail on exactly what are each step of the process. Can we start there?
Okay. There's quite a lot in this topic. So it starts, I think, with a really good job description, a really good job ad. And so our job ads are unusual. They are way more rich and descriptive than other job ads. And so we use audio. We would use video, but we're lazy and audio is easier. And so we have like embedded kind of snippets. So typically we might record, let's say 2-3 minutes of me or someone else talking about why the role is really important, and kind of providing some context about like, here's what my hopes and dreams are for this role. Here's how it fits into the rest of the organization. And the idea behind that, and a lot of other things we do in the job ad, we're trying to give you the richest, realest sense possible of what the job will actually be. And that's because I have a strong belief that there's a lot of human misery, far too much human misery, caused by a mismatch between a person and a role. And it's not that the person is bad or that the role is bad, it's a mismatch. So for example, if you're someone who loves talking on the phone all day and you end up in a role where you're sitting by yourself doing data entry for a lot of the time, or you hate talking to people, mostly strangers, and you end up in a role where you're talking to people on the phone all day, like, those people should just swap jobs. That is a role mismatch problem, right? The problem is that job descriptions suck, right? Like, no one tells you what it's going to feel like. And they don't tell you, they might tell you some of the elements of the job, but they don't tell you what percentage of your time is going to be in each of the elements. You know, they don't tell you the day to day, like, what is your life going to be like if you do this job? No one tells you that. So that's what we try to do. We try to, as well as we possibly can, get you to understand what your life is going to be like. And so another thing that we put in every single job role is we always have a day in the life. And we say, you know, you get into work at 9 a.m. and then we kind of take you through. And what's really critically important in the day in the life is we are not selling you the role. We're not trying to convince you to apply for the job. We're being absolutely as honest as we can about what the role actually is. So if the role involves like some frustration from dealing with stakeholders, you know, imagine you're dealing with some third party that is annoying, like a supplier that's annoying, we will put that in the job, in the day in the life, like that you're annoyed because you're having to deal with this third party person, because that is what the job is going to be. And we don't want you to like quit because you can't deal with frustration. So our aim is to attract the people who read it and think, this is exactly the job for me. But equally importantly, to repel anyone who reads this and goes, well, I don't want to do that. That's fine. Please don't apply in that case. Because we don't want to waste our time or your time, right? So we don't want to like get millions of people applying. We want to get a small number of exactly the right people applying. And so we try to make it as rich as we can.
I almost feel like you could take that to an extreme by having a list of reasons why you shouldn't
this role. That's really good.
Because I've also heard that people do that when fundraising. When they go into fundraising, they go, these are all the reasons that you shouldn't invest in the company. If you still want to talk by the end of them, great.
Yeah.
Then it sets you on like a foot where we've done your due diligence for you almost. And so if you're still in the room at the end of it, we've saved everyone time and then we're probably a match.
I like it. I feel like we could take it up and level. There's always more to be done. Anyway, so that's just the first step. All we've done is advertise the job, right? We've also got a whole bunch of audio clips on our careers page that are about various people like talking about the culture. And so one thing, for example, that I did was I recorded the values discussion that I have with someone and put it on our careers page. And again, I'm really into things that don't take any time, you know, and are not like, we'd never had extra time or money or anything. So all I did was just on my phone with a free SoundCloud account, like started recording a meeting I was already having and then stuck it on the internet. Like, it took 5 minutes. And yet that is one of the things that pretty much every candidate ends up saying, like, I really loved that. It really brought to life, you know, what your culture is and your values and kind of all this stuff. So do that. And so then you click through and then we ask you some screening questions. And I am it's another one of my strong beliefs. I really believe in blind hiring. And this is when you don't look at certainly not a photo or a name, but you also don't look at the institution that or the qualifications or whatever of the person until as late in the process as you can design it. Obviously, at some point you need to find out their name and you need to talk to them and you might need to check the qualifications and, you know, you need to check that they can do the job and you need to check all this stuff. But we basically flip that so that we try to do that later in the process rather than at the start. And at the start, we ask some small number of screening questions. We find that about 4 or 5 is about the right amount. If you put in too many, just people won't do the application. If you put in too few, you're not getting the value. So about 4 or 5. Before we do any of this, we think very, very deeply about what the attributes of the person we're going to need are. And then we create a kind of a matrix that has down one side all the things that we need that person to be able to do or be, you know, or whatever the things are. So, I don't know, like excellent written communication might be a thing, right, that we need. Put them down the first column. And then along the top, we think about all the different touch points in the hiring process that we're going to have. So screening questions is one touch point. Initial phone call might be a second one. Panel interview might be a third one. CEO chat might be a fourth one, whatever, like that kind of thing. And then we think about, okay, how can we map those two things against each other? So at what point at what touch point are we going to get data on all these things that we need? And the aim that we try to get 2 data points on each of the kind of attributes, like written communication, for example. The reason we try to get 2 is because sometimes things go wrong and you need a backup one. And 2 is a good number. But what I find very often when people do a hiring process is they completely miss out this step and they just like randomly do random things and they cannot tell you what they're looking for or why they're looking for it at that point. And it's very inefficient. And you find you get to the end of the hiring process and they've got like 10 data points on one thing and 0 data points on another thing, which means you've wasted a hell of a lot of time getting too many data points on one thing, wasting everyone's time, and you haven't got all the data points. So by the time we get to that decision meeting, we have exactly the data that we need to have in order to make our decision. Because the screening questions, once you've done your matrix, you're like, okay, so what are the things that a screening question could actually tell us? Written communication is a classic one, right? They're going to write, so clearly that you're going to get a read on that one. But there might be some other ones like, have they run a complex marketing campaign before? So you might ask that one.
Could we do an example of this? Let's say hypothetically, I think I'm a very similar type of leader to you in that I'm very much big picture, vision thinking, people oriented, marketing side of things, written communication. That's me.
Yeah.
But then also not great at ops, not detail orientated, haven't generally been systems process, which is, I think, is different to you. So let's say hypothetically I was hiring a COO or an ops person.
Yeah.
What sort of screening questions might you include?
I would derive it from thinking about the grid. Let's say we need you to be detail oriented. I probably would evaluate the screening questions on detail orientation. And the reason I would do that is because having marked a lot of screening questions in my time, like probably 90% of people have some kind of error in their screening questions, like typo or something like that. And so if you don't, that's like a positive mark for your detail orientation. So I think that is actually a quite good data point for detail orientation. But I certainly wouldn't rely, that's only one data point, and I certainly wouldn't rely on all of that. So I would want to test that again. And so I would probably, we would get you to do a task and I would specifically create that task in order to also test your detail orientation. And those would then be my 2 data points, which I would then take to the final decision making. And when we were talking about detail orientation, I would talk about those 2 things.
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
How many of these points are in the grid? Per role? The detail orientation one, do you have 5? Do you have 10? Do you have 3?
Probably 10 to 15, something like that. Probably more the more senior. So if it was a very junior marketing role, it might be more like 5 because you would expect that hiring process to be a bit quicker and fewer stages. Whereas when you're hiring for a COO, that is an incredibly pivotal role. You'd expect to put them through more, you also have references as well. So there are like many, many different sources of data, and references are incredibly important source of data also. But you'll just get more sources of data in general. So you can kind of look across more things.
Okay, yeah. Incredible. Wow. I like am in awe as to how much you've thought about this and how much detail you go into. But also it's just that work up front, which then just saves you so much time down the line. It's like almost like the most leveraged piece of work. If you hire the right people, then you just save yourself so much time, so much energy.
Totally. And the other thing is by the time we actually make an offer, we're pretty high confidence, actually.
How long does it take to go from start to finish, this process?
Sometimes we're a bit rough and ready. So in terms of our, like, when this is like, you know, the 10th priority and we're doing a million other things, so sometimes it's embarrassingly long. But it could be, if it's top priority, we could do the whole thing in like 2-3 weeks, I think.
Wow. I love it, because I imagine your version of rough and ready is probably like very detailed and rigorous compared to lots of people's hiring processes.
Yeah, maybe. I do sometimes reflect, you know, the thing of just like meeting someone and then hiring them is just so weird to me. Yeah. There's two reasons to do blind hiring. One is you can avoid getting bamboozled by like glittery institutions. And I have worked with people who come from who have unimpeachable like records on paper and were just terrible. Like just couldn't do stuff. And it blows your mind that they've managed to kind of like fail upwards consistently through their lives. And so firstly, you avoid accidentally hiring those people who are incredibly expensive. I mean, not just because they are expensive, but also just the chaos and turmoil that they cause. So that's one thing. And then the other thing, the flip side of it, is when you're a startup and you don't have much money and you're trying to do all this stuff, like you've got to find these diamonds in the rough. And the difference between finding a real diamond and just like an average person, if you can do that repeatedly and like bring diamonds together, it's just completely magical in terms of, you know, performance and outcomes and stuff. And the thing that is tough as a hirer is the diamonds in the rough and the average person don't look different on paper. You know, they might have the same class of degree from the same place and have done a couple of slightly random jobs, both of them. But then when you put them through a proper hiring process where you get them to do tasks, you know, and we haven't talked about the tasks, but you just see one of them absolutely excels and the other one is like fine. And so you hire the excellent person.
And then what I imagine that does as well is that if you consistently hire more diamonds, then you just get a higher performing team and those people therefore want to stay in that team for longer.
Yes.
Therefore your retention of employees is higher.
Our retention is amazing. Like I've got multiple people who've been with us for the entire of our 8-year journey, and it is not because they have to be here. Like they could have so many other jobs and they choose to be here because we are a bunch of like incredibly smart, incredibly dedicated, incredibly kind people trying to do really good thing in the world. And you know, it's just good.
Magical combination. So this is all well and good when you have a large top of funnel which gives you a certain number of candidates to then run through this process. So how do you then ensure that when you've put all of your effort into the grid and the job description and this whole screening process, how do you make sure that you get X number of applicants to then find that diamond in the rough?
So I think the richness of the job description is a big part of it, and that is a reason that I have tried to put a lot of effort into our careers page and all that kind of stuff. But aside from that, that's just old-fashioned hustle. Like I remember I was trying to hire, such a hard one, a maternity cover policy and compliance person. Maternity cover roles are always really hard because most people don't want to take a role just for like 9 to 12 months. Most people want a permanent role. So you've already massively cut down the pool. And then this particular role was a policy and compliance role, which was, it required a certain background, but really important judgment, because this is where like the commercial and the policy come together. It was just a very subtle role. It was so hard to get good candidates for this role. And so I just had to do what same thing I have to do on the marketing side generally of the business, which is hand cranking, you know, messaging 500 people on LinkedIn. I think I have about 30,000 LinkedIn connections. That means that I can message second, because you can send a message request, a connection request to second degree. I like almost everyone is a second degree, and or like more people than I can, practically infinite number of people, yeah. Put it that way. And so what that means is that I can send so I can just sit there and do like connection request, and then I put a little thing with the job description in the connection request. And I just did that again and again and again for hours and hours and hours and hours and hours. And it worked. And we found one of the best people in our team who's freaking amazing. So it's just hand cranking.
So then what percentage of your time overall do you think is spent on hiring?
Now, none, because we're not hiring. But in a stage when we were doing a massive expansion, probably 50% maybe. Sometimes up to 100, I think.
Okay. Wow. I would love now to shift gears slightly and talk more about you as a founder.
Okay.
And how you think about various aspects of the founder journey.
Mm-hmm.
And one which I think is such a nuance and like difficult thing, which still relates to the team, is how much should we expect from our team members? We have these sort of examples of successful CEOs like the Elon Musk of the world, who just demand the world from each people, and if they don't reach a certain standard, they're just kicked out, which obviously just removes all of the empathy, all of the kindness out of a system. So then how, with kindness and at your core, do you then also balance that with expecting world-class performance?
This, for me, is the single biggest unsolved mystery of being a founder. So I think about this all the time. And I, by nature, am a reasonable person. And I have a horrible suspicion that incredible results in startups come from being unreasonable. And I think there are tons and tons of examples of unreasonable bosses pushing their teams to incredible outcomes. And so occasionally, because it is literally just not me, but I think I'm one of these. I think I am a person who I push myself a lot. I'm very comfortable pushing myself in all sorts of ways, but I'm very uncomfortable pushing anyone else. And then I see these examples, and I think, oh, maybe I should try like to flex my style. And then I try and do something really unreasonable. And I think partly because it's out of character, and partly just because it's a bit of a dick move, like, just goes down like a cup of sick. And I always end up having to backpedal. I'm not sure I've ever done it and not regretted it. So, for example, in January or just before Christmas, we were planning a launch, and I decided, right, I'm going to set a date, and it's going to be a tough date. And it was going to be, we're going to launch by 31st of January. And I did that, and then it just caused so many problems that I then had to undo. And I think, why am I doing that? So that's why this is an unsolved mystery for me. I hate wishful thinking, and I see other people doing wishful thinking, and it annoys me when I see it. It really annoys me when people want there to be not a trade-off between two things, and so they come up with arguments why there isn't a trade-off, but there actually is a trade-off, and they just don't want to confront reality. So I think there are people who will say, ah, but your people, if you give them trust and you give them empathy and you give all these things, you'll inspire them to greater performance. And actually you can have it all. You can be reasonable and empathetic and have, as you say, a world-class performance. I am not sure that's true. I think that might be wishful thinking. I think there are far more examples of bosses who are just really tough and it leads to world-class performance. The truth that I am in the process of coming to terms with is I don't, because it is not me, and every time I try to be a bit like that, I end up backpedaling. I just don't think we're going to achieve as much as like an unreasonable boss would. I think that's just reality.
I'd love to go into this a little bit. So we're ultimately talking about like the potential of individuals and then them all working together to mean the potential of the team. And so what then contributes to, what are the factors of someone's potential? I suppose it's skill, it's the resources that they have, and then the time element. So you can have a much higher potential in a short space of time. You just work super intensely, but if you carry that on for a long space of time, you'd burn out. If you're under-resourced, then you just can't get things done. It's pretty simple. And then if you just don't know how to do the thing, then you can't obviously also can't get it done. It doesn't seem like all, and most of those are at odds with being empathetic or kind. It's a sort of a pushing people harder. Well, actually, no, then I suppose the last one would be, does someone believe that they can achieve the thing that you want them to achieve? So it's their own belief in themselves. And it feels like the dickhead bosses just say, I don't care whether you believe in yourself or not, you're going to do it, so figure it out.
The thing is, they do it though.
Yeah.
And they don't, they not in every case, but it is, it like it's not uncommon that people actually do rise to that and do stuff that they didn't think they could do. So I don't know. We're talking about an area that is my unsolved mystery. So I don't know how to resolve these things.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I love this area. I think this is so fascinating.
Yeah, me too.
Because I think I'm very similar where I'm, well, I'm a people pleaser, which has good size, and then also it has the detriment where I wouldn't want to push someone hard when they feel uncomfortable. But also I'm also someone that pushes myself hard to the point where I feel uncomfortable. So actually then maybe that's an interesting question. Why are you comfortable pushing yourself hard but not others?
I think it's about consent. You know, I consent to it and I'm the one who will get the benefit of it. Whereas when I'm pushing someone else, not only do they not consent, but I will get the benefit of them working really hard, you know. I don't have any problems asking my children to, you know, uphold behaviour standards. But maybe that's just more that I see them as a bit more of an extension of me.
What do you mean by you don't have their consent?
Well, if you're asking someone to do something they don't want to do, I mean, by definition, right? If they wanted to do it, then it wouldn't be hard.
And is that usually the roadblock? Because there's a difference between like their belief that they can do it and their desire to do it.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I say, this is just an unsolved mystery for me, this area. It is very interesting though.
So interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, one more thing I really wanted to touch on was you seem extremely self-aware with your strengths and therefore hiring the people which complement you and making sure that the areas where you are less strong don't have a negative impact when you're trying to, when you're communicating with the team. Because ultimately your decisions are leveraged through everyone else. And so therefore, if you're too one-sided, then it just doesn't quite work. And you mentioned in a different podcast that when this comes to meetings, for example, and you're very enthusiastic and energetic about something which feels difficult, and someone else who's maybe more critical thinking and detail-oriented would inside challenge that and therefore not be inspired by what you're trying to tell the team to get them all fired up. And you mentioned that this comes back to how well you prepare for your meetings. So can you talk through your system of how you prepare for your meetings?
Depends on the interaction, but if I am going to... if I'm going to be doing something where it's very forward thinking and very kind of visiony, typically I'll make sure that I bring, some people respond to evidence, some people respond to stories. So I tend to try to tell both. So I did one recently actually where it doesn't really matter what the topic was, but anyway, I brought a bunch of academic evidence, but then also told a story and kind of stood up and involved a couple of people in illustrating a point sort of physically. So that's kind of a way to get people on the same page using different kinds of ways of thinking. And then one of the tricks that I really like at the end of a workshop, I actually found that I learned this from all the months where I used to run our nanny trainings in person. So in the early days I used to train all our nannies in person. And I found that if you end the meeting on this one particular thing, the vibe is completely 10x different. And it was either you finish the training and you say thank you very much, it's been a pleasure meeting you all, this is the end, and everyone goes home. In which case, it's kind of like slightly downbeat. People feel a bit tired. They go out and you think, well, I hope they liked it. What I then started doing was instead going around and having everyone use one word to describe. We do something like something you're taking away from today and one word to describe how you're feeling. And the something you're taking away from today, it was amazing how much that changed the vibe, because people were highlighting different types of the training. People didn't want to repeat other people's things. So it ended up sounding as though everyone liked the entire training because all the bits of the training get mentioned. And then most people are, you know, positive people who want to say something nice. So the word to describe their feeling was usually like inspired or energized or something like that. And as you go around and as these people say these words, the actual energy of the room completely changes. When two people that you're sitting next to both say they're feeling energized, all of a sudden you start to somehow feel a bit more energized yourself, you know, no matter what. And I found that those times when I just did that incredibly simple exercise would lead to, like, people, I would be welling up, people would be, you know, hugging, they would be clapping, like just the various types of positive emotion in the room was off the charts through just a simple, different approach to closing that was so simple.
And given that actually we're in the sort of the last 10 minutes of our chat,
yeah,
what is a sort of takeaway that you've taken from, as a point of feedback, yes, as well for me? What's a takeaway from today's?
I love that you asked me a question that I really could not answer. And I'm going to be thinking about that. I think you caused me to think about the reasonableness that stuff to a deeper level than I had before, which, given that I've thought about it a lot, is quite good. Is quite impressive. So that's my thing that I'm going to be thinking about on the tube home, definitely.
Love that. And the one word feeling?
I'm feeling quite zen.
So interesting, because my one word feeling, I actually probably haven't felt this energized and excited,
really,
by an interview in a long time.
I'm
sitting here being like, oh my god, I am like hanging off your every word.
I only told you half the hiring stuff as well.
You've spoken a lot about the hiring stuff in general. Okay, coming to the last couple of questions, we've spoken a lot about what you've done in the past and what you're doing now, but actually looking forward to the future, what does success look like?
So I really, really want Cory Kids to be an enduring institution. And I think we're not that far away from that. And once we get there, I think we'll be able to then, I'm hoping, use what we've built to move into other areas of childcare and, like, really, really make a difference. And I already, I'm already starting to see, one of the things that I'm very excited about is I've spent 8 years painstakingly brick by brick building a process and like internal processes in our product and everything, and essentially a distribution system which now touches like tens of thousands of parents and children and childcare workers. And the distribution system currently just distributes our product, but that distribution system could distribute a lot of other things. You know, we have every day thousands of nannies picking up kids from school and taking them home. What else could they be doing with those kids and kind of in their lives is something I'm very excited about. And we do a little bit on this, but I think we're just scratching the surface on it. So let me tell you what I mean, because I know it's not clear. When you pick up a kid from school and you take them home, this is a very magical time in the day because it's the time when they consolidate what's happened in school, and it's the time when they decide what the stories they're going to tell themselves about what happened are. So if you're AJ and you're 9 years old and you got knocked over in the playground by someone today, and he did it on purpose, you can tell a story to yourself.
Arsehole,
right? There's one story. You can tell an angry story, right? You could also tell a victim story, right? You could think, you know, I'm a person who gets picked on in the playground. You could also tell a connection story. You could focus on the fact that after that happened, one friend ran after him and shouted at him, and another friend took you to the side, and another friend ran and got a teacher, right? Mm. And all of those things might be true. But what is really powerful is the story that you're telling yourself. And that is the foundation of your adult life, is these accumulation of tiny little stories. And the walk home from school is a critical processing time and reflection and narrative time. And I am very excited that my nannies are doing that with thousands of children a day. And so the thing I really want to do is work on elevating that and giving my nannies, our nannies, the tools to give the kids a better life through the things that we do with them just on an everyday basis. And work with third parties, and there are lots of people who are thinking really cool thoughts at the moment about like child mental health and lots of different things that can really add value to children's lives. That's what I mean by we've got a distribution system, mm. I want to plug in all this other cool stuff.
Mm. Applying that same thinking to you personally,
mm.
and recognizing the power of stories. Which area of your life do you think you'd benefit most from a reframe of the story?
I'm generally pretty happy. It is a question I ask myself almost every day is, what's the single thing that improving it would improve my life today? And then I try and work on that thing. And you know, I have like chronic pain in my shoulders, and so that has been like my number one thing that would improve my life. But I'm actually actively working on that, and hopefully it's going to get better. And when I asked myself that same question yesterday, the answer was actually building Cora Kids and doing the thing that I just mentioned. Actually, I think is my number one. That's not the same as a narrative refresh. I'm quite happy with the stories that I tell myself, I think, at the moment.
Wow. I feel like that is a testament to the amount of hard work and reflection and consistency that you've put in for such a long time. And that has shone so brightly throughout this conversation. So
thanks, AJ. I have to tell you something. So I went to a founders retreat that you organised, and it was at West
Lexham,
and we were in that orangery place, yeah. And we were kicking off, and you had these questions which were designed to elicit connections between people. And we went round and you had to move. One person stayed at their desk and the other person moved with every new question, and you were reading out these questions. And they were really meant to be provoking. I can't think of any examples. Maybe you can remember an example of one of the questions.
God, off the top of my head. What was your most treasured memory?
Yeah, okay. Exactly, that sort of thing. And I was kind of skating along the surface. I had some lovely conversations, you know, met some lovely people. But I was like, emotionally, I was skating along the surface right until the last question. And I cannot remember what the question was. The only thing I can remember is my answer. And then I just burst into tears. And my answer was, I just try so hard. I just feel like I try so hard all the time. And I can't, and I remember sort of realizing this, and it was like a dam breaking. And I've thought about that moment quite a lot, because I just try really fucking hard all the time. So it's nice to kind of finally have some of it coming right, which is good.
That just really touched my heart, so I really appreciate you sharing that. Thank you so much.
No problem.